Is he my prince? Is he the toad? Waiting, wondering, is getting too old. I'm gonna let down my hair, slide up my skirt. Welcome to the Shame Free Zone with Veronica Monet, your friendly former sex worker and certified sexologist. The Shame Free Zone is a safe place for your questions and your secrets about all things sexual.
This is Veronica Monet. I'm your host, and you are in the Shame-Free Zone. Welcome. I just got back from San Diego. I was at the 21st Century Book Marketing Conference in San Diego. It was actually pretty phenomenal. But it's always good to be back up here in Northern California, and the weather is actually better here than it was in San Diego, so I'm happy. I hope you're enjoying those last few strains of Indian summer, because I have a feeling they'll be gone soon. We're going to be talking about polyamory tonight, and my guest has actually written a beautiful book. I'm holding it in my hands right now. It's just a gorgeous cover, and I have not read all the contents yet. I have every intention of treating this like a textbook. I'm going to go through and underline and highlight a whole bunch of stuff. And the title is Love in Abundance. I think that's such a beautiful sentiment. A Counselor's Advice on Open Relationships. And the author's name is Kathy Labriola. Now, Kathy's actually a counselor and a hypnotherapist, and she works as a nurse in a private practice in Berkeley. And she herself has been in a polyamorous relationship for about 40 years. So I can't imagine somebody who would know more about what it takes to be in an open relationship. But also just tell you a little bit else about her. She has been considered a bit of an environmental freak. I think that's kind of cute. Because she rides a bike, she grows her own food, raises chickens, and does what she calls extreme recycling. Kathy, welcome to the Shame-Free Zone.
Thank you. Delighted to be in the Shame-Free Zone.
Glad to have you here. So what prompted you to write the book? I'm just wondering. There are some other books. Deborah Annapol's 21st Century, Polyamory in the 21st Century just came out.
Mm-hmm. Very good, yeah.
Yeah, it's a good book, too.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think your unique contribution to the topic is?
Well, the best book out there, which is, I have to say, much better than my book, is The Ethical Slut by Dossie Easton and Janet Hardy.
Dossie Easton, good. Yes, she and I are. We're always doing workshops at the same venue.
Uh-huh, I imagine. Paths cross frequently.
Yes.
Well, their book is terrific. However, a lot of my counseling clients, I was always assigning that as mandatory reading for them. And
uh-huh.
A lot of my clients, it turns out, are such novices at this, and the ethical slut is a little too advanced for them.
Sure.
And so what I really wanted to write was a book that I wanted to call Polyamory for Dummies, because it's really for when you're just starting out and you really are a beginner.
Right.
It does have, I do think that I have some good things to offer people who have been involved in this lifestyle for a while as well. But I particularly thought that was a missing piece in what's out there in terms of the literature.
Right.
As I say, the ethical slut is too advanced for a lot of my clients. And so I wanted to write something that was much more able to meet them where they were at.
So you could consider this kind of a primer in polyamory.
Yes, I think The Ethical Slut is polyamory 2.0, and my book, I think, is 1.0.
Well, I'm sure Dossie wouldn't mind hearing that. I see you've been a political activist for over 25 years. I know you're involved in HIV and AIDS, but has any of your activism been on behalf of polyamory?
Well, I have certainly done a lot of written articles about it and done a lot of radio shows and newspaper interviews. A lot of times newspaper and radio media will call me if they have some kind of a story where there's an angle on that and they're going to want an expert or someone they see as an expert to talk about it. So that's really more of the activism that I have done, is more trying to educate the public and educate the media about it.
Yeah, well, that's actually the kind of activism that I pretty well practice, too. I personally think as long as you're out there making your mark and serving your passion and your purpose, it's all good. And I see you've actually a great deal of experience working with various different types of families and partnerships here. Mm-hmm. You've got monogamous couples and triads and group marriages and HIV positive and HIV negative mixed couples, interracial families, SM and leather community. Let's look at this whole. What is the difference between a non-monogamous couple and a triad?
Generally, a non-monogamous couple is the couple is the basic family unit, and each of the individuals in the couple is likely to have outside relationships, but the couple is the primary pair bond.
Right.
And they may have relationships together with another person, or they may have relationships separately with other people, whereas a triad is usually more of an equal situation where
uh-huh.
There's either two primary relationships or where all three are in a relationship together. For instance, it may be, if it's just for simplicity's sake, let's say there's a heterosexual couple, the woman may have two primary male partners, or the man may have two primary female partners. There may be two separate relationships, or they may be a triad. They may be all living together as a family.
Hmm. Okay. Well, there's obviously a lot of diversity in polyamory, and you know, one of the things that I think comes up a lot in the media is there's a kind of a conflation between polyandry and polyamory. So people think that something like, you know, they're not really Mormons, but sometimes they will consider themselves part of the Latter-day Saints, and as far as I know, they're not. But some of the cults, like Warren Jeffs' cult, is kind of
mm-hmm.
They consider themselves to be practicing some type of Mormonism, even though I'm sure the Mormon Church disassociated themselves
mm-hmm.
from them for a long time ago. But that becomes what the public is familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
And there's an attitude towards that a lot of times, that it's oppressive towards women. And I guess, so I suppose this is a two-part question, is can you distinguish for us the difference between polyandry and polyamory? And then can you also tell us what is the difference in the way that women are treated and whether or not, you know, polyamory affects women adversely?
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe would monogamy be a better option for most women? I think that's a concern that comes up a great deal.
Yes. Well, I'll answer the second part first, which is that monogamy and polyamory are equally liberating to women as long as the women have the choice and as long as the woman has her own autonomy and is able to decide for herself whether she wants to be in a monogamous relationship or
right.
in a polyamorous relationship. So it's not that one is better than the other. It's that neither one should be compulsory and neither one should be controlled by men. The problem with these polygamous type of cults, or polyandry as you accurately described it, are that women have no control, that they are coerced into this lifestyle and they don't have any choice in the matter, and the men are in control. So any relationship style where a woman gets to choose for herself what kind of relationship she wants is ideal for her.
Well, okay. So I think one of the common fears is that a wife is going to be agreeing to a polyamorous arrangement with her husband out of fear of losing her husband. And it may not be her first choice. She may not actually want that, but she says yes to it because she's afraid that her husband will not be happy unless he gets his way around that, in other words. Mm-hmm. So what would you say about that? Does that happen in polyamory?
It does, but it happens just as often the other direction in a heterosexual couple where the woman wants a polyamorous relationship and the man is not so eager to have that but is willing to try it or go along with it.
So you think
he doesn't want to lose his wife or partner.
So that happens just as much?
In my experience, it happens just as often.
Huh. So you're saying that women want open marriages as much as men do?
My experience is there's a higher percentage of men who want an open relationship, more men than women are interested in this.
Okay.
But in my experience, there are a lot of men that are just as reluctant as any woman they're just not really sure. There are an awful lot of men who would like to do this themselves, but they're not sure they want their wife or partner to do this. So,
well, up until recently, I'd have to say that was my experience, was I preferred an open relationship and kept running into men who were very threatened by that. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, for our listeners, you may not know the difference between a chimpanzee and a bonobo, but chimpanzees have a kind of a patriarchal model like we're familiar with in the human culture, which is that sex is a scarce resource that must be controlled and kept for oneself. So chimpanzees mm-hmm. engage in quite a bit of domestic violence, actually, to maintain their so-called breeding access to any particular female. And that's been documented by Dr. Sue Savage Rimbaugh. But with the bonobo, as a contrast to that, there is a very polyamorous environment where there's lots of partners swapping mm-hmm. or sharing, as you might look mm-hmm. at it, and they tend to be a lot more peaceful. So I remember I had a younger lover for a while who used to adamantly announce that, "I am not a bonobo, I am a chimpanzee."
That's great.
Thank you.
That is wonderful.
Well, no wonder we can't get along, because I am
right.
definitely a bonobo.
You're a bonobo.
So
back to your question, I personally, for myself, and I certainly have talked to many other women and seen many other women as clients who see polyamory as a basic cornerstone of feminism for them.
Hmm.
That for them, having control of their bodies in the same way that we want control of our bodies in terms of having the right to birth control and abortion and the right to control our bodies in terms of saying no to rape and domestic violence.
Right.
A fair number of women consider this the right to decide who to have sex with and who to be in relationship with and not to feel that our sexuality is controlled by one man or owned by one man, that we are not handing that over to a man when we get in a relationship with him, that belongs to us.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's more what resonates with me and why I've enjoyed the freedom that an open relationship can bring. But, you know, I'm also looking at page 90 in your book, and you say the cost-benefit analysis of jealousy, and despite their best efforts, some people find that the fear and pain evoked by an open relationship is just too overwhelming. They may decide that it's just not worth the trouble and may opt to return to a monogamous lifestyle, or they mm-hmm. may decide to take their time and work on their relationship to establish a stronger foundation of trust and security while doing their individual growth work to understand and manage their jealousy. A lot of people would say that jealousy is a very normal, natural, and even perhaps healthy emotion.
Right.
Some people even think that jealousy proves that one is loved. It's like, if you don't feel jealous of me, then maybe you don't love me. What do you say about that?
My experience convinces me that jealousy is normal, natural, and it is a response to the threat of loss of some type. Obviously, jealousy occurs in all areas of life, not just in romantic relationships, but in every situation where we do experience jealousy, whether
right.
it's sibling rivalry or, you know, work-related or family or our partner or lover, there is a fear of a loss. There's something precious that we have that we want, and we're fearful of losing it. And in a romantic relationship, we're fearful of losing the love and the loyalty of our partner. We're fearful of losing affection, attention, romance, sex, security, all the things that we have in a relationship that we value. We're fearful of losing them. So it's perfectly natural that if our partner shows some romantic or sexual interest in someone else, that that creates a potential threat to the stability and survival of our relationship. Potential threat, very important to emphasize the word potential. Doesn't mean it is a threat, but it potentially could be.
Well, and I noticed starting on page 65, you've actually got a list of some of the reasons that people have jealousy triggers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, such as your best friend marries someone with a lot of money, or who is much better looking than your spouse, or a friend became more popular than you and was invited into a quote-unquote cool clique.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't get picked for the football team, but other friends made the team. Your parents were busy with their work or other activities and didn't give you as much time and attention as you wanted. If, in fact, some of our jealous urges go that far back, how could one ever hope to move past them?
Well, in the work that I do is helping people learn to manage their jealousy, to understand it, and in order to manage it, they're able to then reduce it. I don't think it's desirable or even possible to completely eliminate jealousy, because I think we're just wired that way to be able to naturally respond with fear and hostility when we feel something precious to us is threatened, which being taken away. So I think it's just normal and natural that we'd react that way.
Right.
But my goal in working with clients is to help them see what the different things are that are triggering their jealousy, and to be able to look at it and see if it's rational or not. Is there really a threat? Is my relationship really in jeopardy?
Mm.
Or am I just being paranoid?
Right.
And
right.
If there is a threat, then working with the partner to try to understand what's going on and trying to strengthen the relationship. If there is no threat, to try to understand why your insecurities are being so triggered and how to manage that, what you need to do for yourself, what you need to ask your partner for, whatever you need to do in order to reduce that.
Hmm.
And it gets easier over time.
How does it get easier over time?
Well, most people who are in a primary relationship, if they start to have outside relationships, or if the partner starts to have outside relationships, the first experience you go through with this, it's much more terrifying because it's in something new you've never gone through before. You don't know what the outcome is going to be. But if, say, your partner gets involved in a new relationship, at first it's very frightening, very threatening. You just have no idea what's going to happen. But after it goes on for a while,
yeah,
everything kind of calms down and your partner doesn't leave you, and
right.
your relationship is going along perfectly happily. There's nothing really wrong. You're not losing out on anything. And
uh-huh.
so you kind of eventually, most people eventually will realize, you know, this isn't really harming me and it's not harming my relationship. And sometimes you can even see, well, you know, this is adding something to my partner's life that's making them happier. And maybe that's making my relationship stronger. Maybe that's making me happier. You know.
Right, right.
And plus now I get to go off and have wonderful relationships with other people too, and that's a real benefit to me. There's something in it for me. So over time, that it's that, as you mentioned, that cost-benefit ratio, over time that shifts. At the beginning, there's a lot of fear, insecurity, pain, anger. There's a lot of very distressing emotions, and there's a lot of negotiation that needs to go on, a lot of communication. It's a lot of work. A lot of time and effort has to go into this. But after a period of time, that cost-benefit ratio usually shifts to the point where you're getting way more joy and way more personal growth out of this and way less pain and distress. And
yeah,
it becomes pretty normalized after a while.
Well, you know, we can get used to anything, but I guess the question is this a... Is it something that can be healthy for women? You talked about it being, for some women, kind of a feminist thing, like they feel that they have all this freedom.
Well, and they're empowered to be really autonomous as women. They don't have to be dependent on one person for all of their emotional needs.
Yeah.
For women, that is usually the motivation more than anything else. It's interesting that for men, it's more likely that more sex or sexual variety is the big motivator for polyamory. For women, it's much more likely to be a scarcity of affection, attention, romance, love, time and energy from their partner.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, you could talk to 100 women, whether they're polyamorous or not, and probably 99 of them would tell you they don't get enough attention and love and affection and romance from their male partner.
Well, I certainly was talking to a woman who confessed that that was an issue in her marriage just yesterday.
Well, I'm a counselor, and believe me, I hear it every day.
I'll bet you do.
I hear from women every day. There's a scarcity of that. This is heterosexual women. For heterosexual women, they just tend to want more of that intimacy, emotional intimacy, attention, romance, affection, and they're not getting enough of it in a monogamous relationship with a man. They're generally much more motivated to go after an outside relationship for that reason than for sex, even though, obviously,
right.
Most women enjoy sex, love sex. I'm not saying they don't do it for the sex, but that's not usually the primary motivator.
Sure. Well, you know, and that brings up an interesting question, which is, you know, that of sex addiction, because if a man's primary motivation is sexual variety, I think one of the things that comes up for women who are in relationships with men is that, you know, it's kind of immature or even possibly kind of an addictive pattern for her man to be wanting all this variety. How does one distinguish a polyamorous personality profile from that of somebody who's dysfunctional and has perhaps addictive tendencies?
Exactly the way you distinguish a social drinker from an alcoholic, that they have control and they make wise decisions versus the sex addict who has no control and makes really bad decisions about who to have sex with, when to have sex. They make bad decisions about breaking agreements with their partners, about not using condoms and getting other women pregnant or coming home and, you know, bringing gonorrhea home to their wife or things like that. That's how you tell the difference between a sex addict and a sort of normal polyamorous male.
Yeah, well, actually, I think the definition of AA, and I would know since I've been in it for 26 years, is that basically if it's creating problems in your life, so, you know, and I have worked, I'm sure you have too, I've worked with bona fide sex addicts, and they lose jobs, go broke, get depressed, and suicidal, and then there's all the rest of the people who are just basically shame-based and feel like, you know, they're wanting to have too much pleasure, too many partners, too much sex, Mm-hmm. Which usually just means that they're happy. They're happy. It's not causing any problems in their life, but
yes,
they're being judged.
Obviously, if it's causing problems in your life, if sex and sexual relationships are causing problems in your life, yeah, you really need to look at that and see if there's some compulsive behavior or some kind of addictive behavior. But it's the same as with alcohol. It's not about how much you drink. It's your relationship with alcohol. It's
not
about how much sex you have with how many partners. It's your relationship with sex. And it's how you treat your partners. I mean, sex addiction is about objectifying partners and not caring how you treat them, not seeing them as human, but treating them in a demeaning manner. And you can do that with one person or with 100.
Right, exactly. Now, and here's something, speaking of one person or 100, and I think this came out in Deborah Annapol's book, Polyamory in the 21st Century, because she talks so much about the fact that, you know, some of the things that polyamory people discuss and work on, I know in all these conferences and workshops and whatnot, so one thing about polyamorous people, they study their relationships. And study the techniques for communication and problem solving and sometimes even, you know, have contracts. But so she was basically, Deborah was indicating that these are skill sets that apply to monogamy. So, you know, even if you're wanting to be monogamous. And in that vein, I'm looking at, you know, how you encourage people to identify their jealousy triggers. You've actually got about three exercises for them to go through to get in contact with their jealousy triggers. But and then you say after they've identified those jealousy triggers, they've got two basic choices. One is to engineer the problem away, and the other is that they can use the phobia model. So can you explain for our listeners the difference between engineering the problem of a jealousy away versus treating your jealousy according to the phobia model?
Yes, it's important to mention they're not mutually exclusive, and most people use some combination of the two, but they're most individuals and couples who are dealing with a jealousy issue will lean heavily towards one versus the other.
Right.
And my experience is that most couples, when they first start out, they need the engineering model. They need a lot of rules, and then as they get a little farther along, they can move into the phobia model. I'll explain the difference between the two. The engineering model says figure out what triggers your jealousy and then make a series of explicit agreements with your partner about trying to avoid those specific behaviors and situations that are most likely to trigger the worst jealousy for you. For instance, amongst heterosexual couples, a big thing seems to be the spending the night with a new partner versus just having sex with a new partner and getting home by 11 or 12.
Yes.
That seems to be a very big issue for a lot of couples. So
that's interesting. You know, actually, I was doing the exercise visualizing, and it was the waking up in the morning that aroused the most jealousy for me.
Waking up in the morning, your partner waking up in the morning with someone else.
Right. Just imagining that was because that's a level of intimacy, as you know, that goes beyond just having sex.
Absolutely, and it's this is more of an issue generally for women than for men because women are much more concerned about their partner developing a deep level of intimacy with another woman, whereas the men are much more freaked out by the female partner having sex with another person and having particular sexual activities and particular sexual things really trigger their jealousy more.
Interesting.
Again, these are gross generalizations that are true about 3/4 of the time about men and women.
Right.
So they're not always true, but there's enough of a trend that we could definitely identify. So the engineering model would say, take something like that. It freaks me out to wake up in the morning and think about you waking up in the morning with someone else. So therefore, we're going to make a specific agreement that for right now, it's fine with you to have sex, for you to have sex with this other partner, but I want you to be come home afterwards, and you might agree on a specific time, like you've got to be home by 1 a.m. or home by 11 or whatever is, you know, reasonable and appropriate.
Sure.
And that's engineering out the problem. You're saying, if I were an engineer looking at this situation, here's how I'd fix it. I would say, let's just not have this problem. Anyway, that's just one example. For instance, heterosexual men, for some reason, a very big trigger for a lot of them is their female partner having a fellatio with a man, performing oral sex on another man. Something about intercourse does not seem as threatening to them as something about that is very distressing. And so some heterosexual couples will make an agreement, okay, no fellatio with another man. And that...
Oh, wow. So it's like you could have sexual intercourse with him, but if you're going to actually perform oral sex on him, then I feel very threatened.
There's something about that that is seen as very intimate, more intimate even than intercourse, or somehow demeaning or humiliating if you do it with someone else.
Interesting.
Yeah, I've never understood it, but I've heard it so many times from men that I just have to accept that that's something that is very distressing to them.
Yeah.
Even more so than intercourse, which surprised me.
It's a surprise to me, too.
Uh-huh. Sounds like you haven't run into that.
I have not.
Uh-huh.
I have not, no. I've run off, actually, into the other thing, like I don't want my wife to perform fellatio on me because she kisses my children with that mouth.
Yes, I've heard that. Yeah. So that those are just examples. You know, other examples are I get very distressed if you spend a weekend with someone else. The weekend is prime time. That's my time. So I go see your other lover on Tuesday night, you know?
Right.
But save the weekend for me.
I hear
that a lot from couples that are, particularly married couples, that are just used to spending every weekend together, and
that's
the time that they usually spend together. It's hard for them to accept that some of that time is being taken up by someone else. They consider it, that's my time.
It sounds like a couple almost has to go through one by one, and that this would be changing a lot.
Yes, over time it definitely does change. I utilize a number of these exercises that you just mentioned, jealousy exercises, to help people identify what those triggers are. Because oftentimes when someone comes to see me for counseling, they just say, oh my God, I'm so jealous, I can't even think straight. And I say, well, what are you actually feeling? And they'll say, well, I just told you I'm jealous, you know. But saying I'm jealous doesn't actually tell you anything. It doesn't really give you any information. So I try to ask them to identify, are you more frightened, angry, or sad? These are the three primary negative emotions. And for most people, one of those three is going to be primary in terms of their jealousy reaction. And sometimes I say, is it terror, rage, or despair? Because for some people, that is how they describe it. I mean, their jealousy just creates such an intense emotional reaction that they are not just feeling a little bit frightened, they're feeling terrorized. And they're not just feeling a little angry, they're enraged. Or they're not just feeling sad, they are in total abject despair.
Wow.
So I try to ask them to identify how much of what they're feeling is fear-based, how much is anger-based, and how much is sadness or hurt-based. And there are probably 25 emotions or feelings that are fear, and there's probably another 25 that are anger, and another 25 that are sadness. And they will describe all of them in great detail, and I have to try to isolate them as one of those three. What are they? What is each feeling closest to of those three primary painful emotions?
And jealousy is a painful emotion. You also talk about what to do if your partner is jealous. And you recommend empathy and good communication, of course, which, you know, are words that sound good to almost everybody. And yet a lot of people, I find, the couples that I work with, have such a hard time even understanding what empathy and good communication might look like. And you admonish, you know, don't try to fix it for them by making the feelings going away or challenging the rational basis. One of the things I liked about you, you made this distinction that when you try to get into an intellectual discussion, you're accessing that part of the brain. And really, when somebody's jealous, That's all about their feelings, and it has nothing to do with the intellect. I'm really sorry about that interruption. We had a little technical difficulty, but we are back. And we were right in the middle of finding out what to do when your partner gets jealous. Now, you know, you don't have to be in an open relationship to be worrying about jealousy. We all deal with that all day long. I mean, even if you're only in a relationship with a dog, you have to deal with your dog
being
jealous.
That's true. There's always competition for your time and attention, that's for sure.
I went to pick up my dog from doggy daycare yesterday. I'd only been gone for about 3 days. She was getting along beautifully with a whole house full of critters, from rabbits to a rat to a cat, about 5 different dogs. She loved everybody. She was absolutely perfect little angel. I came in there, and she was so happy to see me, and then one of the little dogs came up to try to get me to say hello to him, and she let out the most vicious growl. So it does seem like it's part of our mammalian instinct, if you will, but you
yes.
were in the middle of telling us what to do if your human partner is experiencing a jealous meltdown. So,
okay, well, I always give my clients their mantra. If they're having a jealous partner, the mantra is shut up and listen. And I know it's kind of blunt, but the reason I make it so blunt is that they have to be just stop arguing and stop defending and justifying anything and just listen. Because when your partner is having a jealousy meltdown of any kind, they are not really at their most rational, and they need compassion and a lot of reassurance that you love them, you care about them, that you're not trying to hurt them. And they're distressed, and they're often kind of expressing it in an angry way. And so your natural impulse is to feel defensive and to try to say, well, I didn't do anything wrong, and I didn't break an agreement, and I didn't, why are you mad at me? You have no right to be mad at me. And that doesn't work, though, at all, because argument is about thoughts, and jealousy is about feelings. And so you're saying thought, and they're saying feelings, and you say thoughts, they say feelings, and you can see there's no communication going on there at all. So I try to tell them, here's your mantra, shut up and listen. Just listen carefully to exactly what your partner has to say and try to validate their feelings. And I tell them to validate their feelings, don't validate delusions. And what I mean by that is, if your partner says, well, I'm just afraid you're going to leave me, you don't want to validate that by saying, yes, I'm going to leave you. You want to validate it by saying, I understand that you're feeling frightened and insecure right now, and I understand how my behavior could have created that or encouraged that, but I love you, I'm not going to leave you. et cetera. So you're wanting to validate the fact that they are having these very painful feelings, and this is very difficult for them, but you want to encourage them to understand what really is actually true about the situation. A delicate balance.
I would think it would be a hugely delicate balance.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I think you also recommend, you know, sometimes taking a time out and not trying to solve it in the moment.
Yes, and especially the not trying to explain what the situation, how the situation feels to you.
Yeah.
Because right now they can't really hear that. It's much better to bring that up later when they're feeling calmer.
Right, and part of that is not, as you say in these zero words, don't agree to something just to appease your partner if you're going to resent it later. So.
Oh, absolutely. No, you don't. You certainly don't want to agree to something that you're really not going to be able to sustain. And that there is a danger of that when your partner is really in acute distress. You can be...
You want to solve it. Oh, baby, I love you, and please don't solve
I'll do whatever makes you happy.
Yeah.
Well, it's also very important at that moment to try to ask your partner in a gentle way whether they actually are asking for any change in your behavior or whether they just want their feelings to be validated and heard.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of times you can jump to the conclusions that because my partner's upset, that means they want me to do something different next time. And
yes,
a lot of times they don't.
In my case, I definitely make a distinction there. And just because something threatened me or made me feel jealous doesn't mean that I want my partner to affect a change in their behavior. Sometimes I just want to have my feelings validated.
Absolutely. And that's frequently, that is the number one misunderstanding and communication breakdown for polyamorous people is that one person just wants to be acknowledged and understood and heard, and the other person thinks they are asking for a change in behavior.
Yeah.
And it can lead to a lot of problems.
Well, it can, and I know for myself, my partner doing something to try to affect a change in my emotion, it doesn't help me feel different.
Mm-hmm.
What helps me feel better is actually getting the nurturing and the love that I want.
Mm-hmm.
I actually find that there's quite a bit of distancing in having just, oh, well, here then, let's fix it. I won't do this anymore.
Right, and that's not what you're asking for a lot of times. So I really encourage couples to be very clear and ask, well, are you needing support and reassurance from me right now? Or are you asking for a change in our agreement or a change in my behavior? And really be explicit about that so that you understand what your partner actually wants from you. And 9 times out of 10, they just really want to be acknowledged for the fact that they've just done something that's really hard for them.
Yeah.
Usually it's because you've gone off on a date with someone and had sex with someone, or something is happening with your other partner and you're spending a lot of time with them. Your partner just wants you to acknowledge that, wow, I'm really doing something that's difficult for me, and it's putting me through some stress, and I'm feeling distressed, and I want to be recognized for that.
Mm-hmm.
I want you to acknowledge that I'm doing this, and I'm trying to handle something that's really difficult for me.
Yeah, and help me do it.
Right.
Make this easier on me
by giving me some support.
Well, it begs the question here. And do you think that polyamory is kind of a growth model, calling upon people to grow past some of their more entrenched, patterns? That's one model, and that tends to be the model that I ascribe to. I think polyamory is more work. It requires one to evolve and stretch and grow. But some
mm-hmm.
people would see polyamory as being immature and self-indulgent, and they would think that, keeping a commitment to be monogamous would require a great deal of self-restraint. So
mm-hmm.
what do you think about those two models?
Well, there's a kernel of truth in both of them, but the reality is it's about a person's basic sexual orientation rather than about which one is more work or which one requires more personal growth or which one requires more maturity and commitment. It's more about, is your basic innate sexual orientation towards an exclusive pair bond, or is your basic sexual orientation towards multiple partners?
Mm.
Because if you really are inherently monogamous, and some people clearly are, they will never be happy in a polyamorous relationship, and they should not go in that direction. It's just like somebody gay trying to be straight. It's never going to make them happy. It doesn't express who they are as a person and how they love. So some people really are inherently monogamous. They want exclusivity from a partner because that is the only kind of relationship that makes them feel truly loved and valued. Whereas some people are inherently polyamorous. And
no
matter
really
who that partner is, they're never going to be completely satisfied with one partner.
So you want to take a non-judgmental approach to that and really honor where people are at. What are some of the problems with open relationships?
What's that?
What are some of the problems with open relationships?
Well, the biggest one is the one that we've already described to some extent, which is jealousy. That jealousy is a huge obstacle for people learning how to navigate polyamorous relationships. And some of that is, I believe, as I've said, innate. I think it's just natural. And some of it is learned. Some of it is behavior that we've learned because these are the values that we were raised with in a very aggressively monogamous culture. Not that people really are monogamous in this culture, but it's a model that's promoted very heavily by religions and government and everything else. But there is some of that jealousy that is actually really learned and can be unlearned if you are, in fact, not an innately monogamous person.
Wow.
And there have been a lot of researchers and scientists and anthropologists and all kinds of people that have done a lot of research on jealousy in different cultures around the world. And there's a huge there's a lot of diversity in different cultures in terms of how much jealousy exists and how it manifests and under what conditions it manifests. So certainly some of it is culturally imprinted by the way that we're raised.
Mm. I love your model there of, basically saying there's monogamous people and non-monogamous people. What about core beliefs that generate jealousy? You've actually got those elucidated, and I think you've got like three core beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
If my partner really loved me, he or she wouldn't have any desire for a sexual relationship with anyone else. If my partner were happy with me, if I were a good partner, spouse, lover, etc., my partner would be so satisfied that she or he wouldn't want to get involved with anyone else. And or number three, it's just not possible to love more than one person at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes, now these are beliefs that are culturally imprinted. These are beliefs that we are taught from birth that these three things are true. And in fact, they really aren't true. We've been taught these beliefs, and these three beliefs are guaranteed to generate intense jealousy. And the more you are invested in any or all of these beliefs, the more you will inevitably experience jealousy. And the more you can reduce your investment or your belief in any of these three core beliefs, the less jealousy you will have.
And you've actually rewritten the three core beliefs. And you've got core belief number one. These are new things. I guess we can use them like affirmations to kind of reprogram our brain.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. My partner loves me so much that he or she trusts our relationship to expand and be enriched by experiencing even more love from others. My relationship is so solid and trusting that we can experience other relationships freely. My partner is so satisfied with me and our relationship that having other partners will not threaten the bond that we enjoy. And new core belief number 3, there is an abundance of love in the world, and there is plenty for everyone. Loving more than one person is a choice that can be exponentially expanding my potential for giving and receiving love. And I love what you said about that. You know, the fact that these new beliefs sound so strange and almost laughable is to us at first shows just how deeply the old paradigm beliefs about love and relationships are ingrained in our consciousness. And what are those old paradigm beliefs?
What's that?
The old paradigm beliefs that are deeply ingrained.
Those are those 3 core beliefs that you just read. And the first one is, if my partner really loved me, they wouldn't have any desire for a sexual relationship with anyone else. Well,
right.
That you can see that it's on the face of it absurd. I mean, the idea that you would go through your whole life and never have any attraction towards anyone else besides this one person that you're in a relationship with is absurd. I think even people that are 100% monogamous acknowledge that they do have attractions towards other people.
Sure. Even, what was that, President Carter lusted in his heart?
That's right. He told Barbara Walters he was lusting in his heart.
That's right.
I don't know if he's lusting after Barbara Walters,
now.
But he was lusting after someone in his heart. So it's absurd, but it's based on a belief that the amount of love your partner has for you is going to keep you from having any interest in another person. It's a quantitative view of love.
Yeah.
And that any interest that your partner has is a direct reflection of how much they love you or how much they don't love you.
Absolutely.
Whereas the second belief, so the first belief, you can at least blame your partner. It's their fault because they don't love me enough.
Yeah.
With the second core belief, it's even more insidious. It's if my partner were happy with me, and if I were a good partner, my partner would be so happy with me, they would never have any interest in getting involved with anyone else. Well, that's more insidious because then it's your fault. It's like, I wasn't a good enough partner, I wasn't a good enough lover or a good enough spouse, and so that's why my partner is interested in someone else. Now, that's inevitably going to generate intense jealousy if you think that any interest your partner has in another person is a direct reflection of your worth as a person and your inadequacy as a partner and lover.
Mm-hmm.
Naturally, that's going to make you incredibly insecure.
Yeah, it really is. And I think that's the whole point about jealousy, is that it does create so much fear and so much pain. It's not an expansive emotion. It doesn't encourage us to love more, to feel more, to tell more of our truth. It really, reacting towards jealousy, I think, creates all this tamping down and shutting down and getting smaller and controlled and holding your energy in. Oh, I better not look. Oh, I better not flirt.
It's built on this scarcity economy of love, that there's love, the idea that love is a finite resource and there's only a little bit of it and there never is going to be enough, so you know, I better hang on to what little bit I have, and I can't share it with anyone, or my partner can't share any with anyone, or they would be less for me. Just like there's 10 ounces of love in the world, and you don't want anyone to get 1 ounce of it, you know. That it means there's not going to be enough for
it's
me.
That's true. Well, Kathy, this interview just whizzed by. It's a fascinating and wonderful topic, and I personally just share, I think polyamory may not be for everybody, because like you pointed out, some people are probably born monogamous, but I do believe it's a model that that a lot of people would probably gravitate towards if they weren't shame-based. And I think
don't have the time and energy for it. I mean, some people just don't.
That too.
Naturally, they don't want to put all that effort into it, and I don't blame them. They've got other things to do that are more important to them.
Yeah,
more power to them.
But I think the polyamory model is more geared towards a peaceful coexistence. I really do. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about where they can get your book?
Yes. It is called Love in Abundance, A Counselor's Advice on Open Relationships. And they can get it through Greenery Press, which is the publisher, or they can get it through online through the Stock Room, which is www.stockroom.com. And it is also available on Amazon.
Oh, fabulous. Fabulous. You have a practice in Berkeley, so how can potential clients contact you?
That's great. Okay.
Oh, no, how would they contact you?
What's that?
Potential clients?
Oh, my office number is 510-841-5307, or they can contact me through email. My email address is anarchofeminist@yahoo.com.
Oh, great. Kathy, thank you so much. You were a delight to interview, and again, sorry to you and our listeners that we had that little bit of a brief lapse there
being
on the air.
And, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Oh, it was fun. It was fun. We'll have to have you back. Next week, my guest will be Dr. Susan Campbell. We are going to be talking about truth in dating and beyond the power struggle. That should be really good. I look forward to chatting with all of you again next Monday. Good night for now from the Shame Free Zone. Bye.
Thank you for tuning in tonight. If you liked what you heard and you want more solutions for your love life, please call me toll-free at 888-903-0050. Once again, that number is 888-903-0050. I am the only person who answers that line, and I am usually available Monday through Friday from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. Pacific Time. You can also visit sexwithoutshame.com to discover more of what I can do for you. And remember, your secret is safe with you. Sering kesepian, kenapa tak mutus kabar berita?